Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This weekend, as always, lots and lots of arts options for you, and we'll focus on three of them today. Beginning with, remember your first doll? My three guests today sure do. They're presenting the exhibit Loved Through the Years, Three Centuries of Black Dolls at Delta Fine Arts. Then we're off to the cinema with Triad Jewish Film Festival's Brian Kaiser and part two of our sneak peek at TJFF 2012. We'll wrap things up today with a return back to the 18th and 19th centuries and Our Spirited Ancestors, the Decorative Art of Drink, with Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts Associate Curator Daniel Ackerman, and the second half of our conversation, next on Triad Arts Weekend. The exhibit Love Through the Years, Three Centuries of Black Dolls opened last week and will continue through March 31st at Winston-Salem Delta Fine Arts. Last week, doll maker Wendy Barber, United Federation of Doll Clubs Region 8 Director Carolyn Mills Allen, and collector, doll appraiser, dealer, genealogist, and lecturer Joyce Stamps stopped by the studio to share their passion for dolls.
My mom, when I was 13, she said I was too old for dolls, and she refused to buy me any more dolls. And I said, okay, so I really started reading, and I read a lot. Back then, there were hardback books only. So I started collecting a lot of books, and my mother saw the books collect, and she said, don't you think you have enough books? And I said, well, it's either the books or the dolls. Which one? And she said, keep reading. Little did she know, my favorite aunt kept me in dolls. Once a month, my aunt would take me to Hudson's and buy me a doll from the toy department. So I had both.
Your creations today, a combination of influences from Africa, Asia, European traditions.
Yes, I have a degree in costume design.
What are some of the distinguishing features of each?
European, of course, what we're wearing today and now, and then the Asian style of the kimono, the obi belts, things like that. And African prints, I put them all together and create one doll.
Is it a mix? I mean, a mix of styles?
It's a mix. Uh-huh. A mix of styles, textures, pattern. I'm branching more out to using satins and silks and more textured fabrics because basically they were all cotton. And most of my dolls are cloth dolls, but now I'm branching into polymer clays and air-dry clays. So I'm trying everything, and I love puppets, so I'm about to get into puppets and teaching that for kids in workshops and things.
See, I would make a puppet. I've always had that fascination with puppetry.
Yes.
Would like to say that one day I'll make a puppet.
Yes.
That'd be my goal. You heard it
yes.
here first.
Well, when I have a workshop, I'll let you know.
Talking to Carolyn Mills Allen here, and the organization I wanted to find out more about, to which you're both members, and this is the United Federation of Doll Clubs Incorporated. What's it do?
First of all, our mission is to promote doll collecting, doll preservation, and to educate people who think they're not doll collectors. And we have 16 regions, and that includes an international region. I'm regional director of Region 8, which includes Tennessee, North Carolina, and Kentucky. We do community activities. We promote the preservation of dolls and the collecting of dolls and the study of dolls. There's a doll club in Winston-Salem, one in Greensboro, and one in Salisbury, not to mention the other surrounding counties.
How does that experience leading the regional chapter of the Federation helped you or just influence you in terms of your own collecting?
I have learned more by attending our conventions where we see pristine dolls, the creme de la creme in each category. We do have a competition where dolls are awarded ribbons. We have an apprenticeship judging program where you can learn to judge dolls. So it's an ongoing relationship with the membership, which numbers over 12,000 members worldwide.
Your personal collection, it includes a real variety of some of the modern makers representing some important aspects of collecting dolls of color. What are some of those aspects?
First of all, if you find a person of color, a doll designer or a person who owned a factory or a company, to me that's not only part of doll history, it's an important part of African American history. And because the doll and the toy company has moved to Asia, any doll that we have made in America is important. But then when we find one and we can document one that was made or designed by a person of color, that's even more important. So we can go back probably to the 50s and 60s where we find a lot of women survived by being doll makers. They made money by being doll makers. So my examples are very important. I have a Amos Andra doll, which is from a radio program that was called the Amos and Andy Show. And there was a doll created from a character in that genre. She was made of rubber by the Goodyear Company. So she's fragile, she's rare, and there were two versions that we know of. She had a painted eye and a plastic or glass eye. So that's radio history, that's African-American history, that's toy history, fashion. And the Mattel Company now has a black designer who designs a collection once a year. And it is over the charts, out of this world, pure fashion.
You beautiful doll, you great big beautiful doll.
Hey, we got Joyce right in front of me. This is clearly a lot more than just a hobby. Why is this so important to you? What is it about them?
I brought to Winston-Salem antique dolls. A friend of mine who owns an antique store in Massachusetts has a collection of about 150 black cloth dolls. And a lot of these dolls were made by slaves for their children. Most of the women back then sewed, so they had scraps that they used. And these dolls come from the earliest that we have in the collection. I didn't bring that one with us. It's from 1830. Most of the dolls that I brought with me this trip were from, I would say, 1850 up to about 1920. My other passion, and I've been able to combine the two, is genealogy. And I can go back to the early 1800s.
What's that like? There's a doll from that period that may have been in the rough area of an ancestor. What's that connection like?
It's kind of a feeling that you get, you know? It just kind of takes over. I was here 2 years ago at the convention center, and I brought dolls with me. I was invited by Dolls Magazine to do kind of a historical look on black dolls, cloth dolls, and that's what I did. And there were several people that came into the booth. I would say the majority of them were white. And believe it or not, they were men. And a lot of them came in, and a couple of them got a little complaint, close to tears. And I said, please don't cry in here. But they were remembering things that their mothers had when they were younger and dolls that had come into their life. And a couple of them said that they really wanted a baby doll just to have, because it made them feel closer to their mother. They remember some of the things that they felt, and that's how I feel sometimes with the dolls that I come across.
The connection.
The connection. It was like when I went to pick some of them up to bring down this trip, I mean, I was just amazed at myself, especially when you figure out how early these dolls were. And I said, one of the things I would like to do is I would love to be able to have them tell me the stories that they did, how they felt, the children that were given to them, how they played with them, what they felt.
My thanks to collector, doll appraiser, dealer, genealogist, and lecturer Joyce Stamps, United Federation of Doll Clubs Region 8 Director Carolyn Mills Allen, and doll maker Wendy Barber. You can see their remarkable dolls in person at the Delta Fine Arts exhibit Love Through the Years, Three Centuries of Black Dolls, which opened last week and will continue through March 31st. The Antique Doll Roadshow and Evaluation is Saturday, February 25th from noon to 2, and a children's doll making class will be held Saturday, March 31st from noon to 3. You'll find more information, along with photos of several dolls that my guests brought along with them today, on our website, wfdd.org/triadart. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and you're listening to 88.5 WFDD, your NPR News and Triad Arts station from Wake Forest University. The Triad Jewish Film Festival is committed to sharing cultural experiences that bring us all together, bridging divides of religious beliefs, nationality, and ideology. This year, they're delivering on all fronts big time with a lineup that's as educational and enlightening as it is entertaining. The festival opens on Saturday night, February 25th at 7:30, and it'll run through Saturday night, March 10th. You'll find links to the complete screening schedule, location, and ticket information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Last week, Festival Chair Brian Kaiser spoke with me from WFDD's Greensboro studio. Here's part two of our conversation. As is the tradition with the Triad Jewish Film Festival, a real mixture of genres, from just the intensity of that documentary we just spoke of, Knowledge is the Beginning, to a really fun, more lighthearted romantic comedy, Salsa Tel Aviv. And what a great premise. A single unemployed mom in Mexico travels to Israel to find work, but she's traveling as an undercover nun.
You know, what's funny about that, the lead actress here is actually the original Ugly Betty. So anyone familiar with the ABC American television show of that same name, this is the actress that started that role in Mexico.
Angelica Valle?
Yes.
She's great.
She's great. And, you know, we always try to find a lighthearted film. Now, this one just happened to fit in with the overall theme. In this case, it's salsa dancing that brings two people together, another shared cultural experience. But in this instance, it's actually exploring that Israel itself has illegal immigration or people looking for work by crossing international borders. I never, for one, assumed people would travel from Mexico to Israel to find employment. But this movie kind of brings that to life, not in a political way, but just to show the clash of cultures when you bring salsa dancing to a vibrant city like Tel Aviv.
Throw in a little mistaken identity, language gags, love story, and you got yourself a movie.
The language may be different, but the situations and the chaos that reigns supreme is very similar to what you would see in an American romantic comedy.
A nice mix with the concert in terms of the comic elements and some drama. And again, another interesting premise. It really begins with a fired Bolshoi conductor's interception.
Yes, the concert, again, continuing that theme of how music really brings people together, tells the story of a Bolshoi conductor who's exiled from his post, basically demoted to janitor for the same orchestra, and he intercepts a fax, which seems archaic, but he intercepts a fax intended for the music director for the Bolshoi, inviting them to play a show in Paris. Rather than pass that fax along, he decides to reconstitute his orchestra from years ago, all his musicians that had been exiled themselves, bring them together. It's sort of like the Blues Brothers getting the band back together and go to Paris posing as the Bolshoi Orchestra and to reclaim their glory. And that glory is manifest in performing a Tchaikovsky piece that they had not yet mastered 30 years previously. And in order to deliver that piece, they invite a soloist. And the soloist has a connection from their past that I will not divulge the surprise, but it was very emotional. And even with all the comedy, it really cut through that to really deliver a gut punch at the conclusion.
In addition to the great music, and we're talking about the Tchaikovsky Violin Concerto, and what a wonderful performance in the movie, some really nice film work showing the interactions between the various musicians and the soloist and conductor.
It's a powerful piece. In fact, the concert performance shown in the film is done as a long take. You almost feel as if you have a front row seat to a classic performance. It's an amazing scene, and just the sheer emotion being portrayed in the music itself really speaks to how that is a common language that everyone can relate to. And that's one of the reasons we chose that one as our opening night selection.
Well, everyone can relate to a hero, and in the case of Nikki's family, really a reluctant hero, an unbelievable both combination of drama but a true story, and the way one individual, Nicholas Winton, impacted 5,700 people who are alive today because of his efforts around World War II.
Yeah, not only was he a reluctant hero, he had a sense of humility, which I think really speaks to the values, I think, of that generation. That his work to save hundreds of children from certain death, and then those children subsequently going on living lives and raising their own families without ever knowing who saved them, for 50 years, he never shared this role he had played in the dawn of World War II with anyone, even his own family. And it was only a chance discovery in the attic of his home of his logbooks from what he had done in the dawn of World War II that brought this to light. And I think that really speaks to sort of the flip side of our Facebook share everything culture, that here's a man who did something literally world changing, and he hid it away in an attic for 50 years.
What a great way of putting that, Brian, to point that out, because it seems like in this day and age, you see something bizarre, even just walking down the street, you'll flip out that iPhone and film it and put it up on YouTube for the whole world to see. And here's a guy who saved hundreds of lives, as you mentioned, and just thought that he was just doing the right thing.
And what the film gets into is not only the families and descendants of those he had saved, but the impact of his actions, the inspiration he provided to so many other people around the world once they learned of what he had done in modern days. So 50 years later, his acts are still resonating through the world. He was knighted by Queen Elizabeth and continues to inspire children, adults around the world to sort of pay it forward. And that is one of the things the film gets into. And the other component is they show clips from his appearance on sort of a This Is Your Life reality show. And it creates a scene of an audience of people who each in some way were touched by his actions 50 years prior. And I guarantee if you go to see this film, bring some Kleenex. I don't care if you're, you know, the most stoic guy around. You can't help but be affected by this man's humility and this man's sense of honor.
His story is incredible, and the movie also has a remarkable blending of scenes from the past, from the time of World War II before and shortly after, with a film of Nicholas Winton today and the people that he saved and the impact he's had. It is, as you mentioned, just an extremely powerful film.
The two others, Laroff, is an award-winning film from France, and it does star actors that people might have heard of. It's actually the same story as Sarah's Key, which a lot of people are familiar with. And then the Eli and Ben is an Israeli film. Israeli cinema has really been taken off. I know you and I have been talking about that for several years, but I think there was even a story in Newsweek recently about the emergence of the Israeli cinema. And the quality of filmmaking has really gotten international recognition, and that's one of the films this year from that industry.
Part two of my conversation with Triad Jewish Film Festival Chair Brian Kaiser. He spoke with me from WFDD's Greensboro studio. TJFF enlightens, educates, and entertains, and it also forms strong partnerships in the Greensboro community. On Sunday, March 4th at 2 o'clock, immediately following the powerful documentary Knowledge is the Beginning, about young musicians from all across the Middle East coming together at the behest of Daniel Barenboim to form an orchestra, Eastern Music Festival violin faculty member Daniel Skidmore will perform. The Triad Jewish Film Festival opens on Saturday night, February 25th at 7:30, and it'll run through Saturday night, March 10th. You'll find links to the complete screening schedule, location, and ticket information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to 88.5 WFDD, your NPR News and Triad Arts station from Wake Forest University. I'm David Ford, and when we get back from the short little intermission, we'll jump back into time to join our spirited ancestors, the decorative art of drink, with Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts Associate Curator Daniel Ackerman. It's the second half of our conversation next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. The Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts is one of the Triad's best-kept secrets. It's at Old Salem Museums and Gardens, and its most recent exhibit, Our Spirited Ancestors, the Decorative Art of Drink, will remain on display through September 2012 in the G. Wilson Douglas Jr. Gallery. The Decorative Art of Drink explores the furniture, silver, ceramics, and glassware that enhanced the days and nights of early Southerners. Last week, MESDA Associate Curator Daniel Ackerman spoke with me by phone from Williamsburg, Virginia. Here's part two of our conversation.
Well, the Piedmont of North Carolina has a really huge decorative arts legacy, and it's something that we see today, whether it's in the furniture industry in High Point or all of the pottery that North Carolina is known for today, the contemporary potters. In the period, Salem was one of the primary trade centers for the North Carolina Piedmont. And Salem itself was a town dedicated to the trades. So people would come from all around to buy furniture, pottery, metalwork, things like that from the craftsmen in Salem. There are great stories of people lining up on the days that the pottery would be put for sale and coming to Salem to buy remarkable earthenware with slip decoration and things of that sort. So Salem has always been a real center for the arts in North Carolina and in the South. So it's actually a really neat thing that MESDIS located there.
The exhibit, Our Spirited Ancestors, the Decorative Art of Drink. The comment that jumped out at me is early Southerners drank nearly 20 gallons of alcohol annually. The early Southerners, what time period are we talking about? And how did that compare to other regions back then in terms of that consumption?
Well, I'm talking about people drinking from when the first English set foot at Jamestown in 1607 until the first shots are fired at Fort Sumter in 1861. And Southerners were not particularly unique in their drinking. Early Americans in general drank a lot. They drank when they woke up. They drank while they worked, they drank while they ate, and they drank while they enjoyed the company of friends. Drinking was just something you did, and one of the real reasons why was that drinking alcohol was safer than drinking murky, sewage-filled water. So by drinking alcohol, you're really accomplishing a number of things. You're preserving grain and fruit crops. You are creating something that is making hydration, making drinking safe, and you're getting sort of a pleasant buzz at the same time. It's sort of the perfect solution.
You write here, in the early American South, it wasn't the fact that you were drinking. Most everyone was, but what you drank and how you drank it that defined who you were in society. Daniel, what was that drink spectrum like back then, and what did it say about the drinker and their place in society?
Well, at the most basic level, people are drinking home brews. They're drinking things that are, in essence, preserving their crops. They're drinking homemade ales. Homemade cider is an incredibly important thing. They're drinking homemade wines. MESDA has in its collection an early manuscript cookbook from Hanover County, Virginia, from the 1740s. It contains several dozen recipes for ales, wines, ciders, beers. A step up from that is importing alcohol, which is always a dicey process in the 18th century. You have no idea the quality of what's going to arrive on the ship for you. And people write to their London merchants that, you know, the first bottle of wine they drank was the best they'd ever had, but the second was awful. But they drank it anyway because they paid for it and it got there. One of the reasons people drank Madeira in particular is Madeira has such a high alcohol content that it actually improves the worse it's handled. So it actually fared well on these sea voyages. On top of that, you could drink things like punch, where you're now distilling the alcohol and you're going to mix it with foreign ingredients, sugar, citrus, you're going to mix it with spices like nutmeg. And punch is a wonderful social drink. Not only are you taking all of these things from around the world, putting them in a bowl, but you're then passing the bowl around a circle and drinking directly out of it. On top of that, you have distilled beverages, things like whiskey, which become incredibly important, especially in the late 18th century when farmers moving into the American backcountry need a way to turn their crops into something profitable, but also easy to move. And so they start turning things like corn into whiskey. Then finally, you have in the 19th century the rise of sort of a cocktail culture, which in a lot of ways is punch in a glass. And the julep is probably the best known of that. It's one of those great Southern drinks that we all associate with the South, but also with decorative arts, with drinking it out of literally a silver cup.
Just as important as what they were drinking back then was the bottles, the jugs, cups, and glasses that were used to hold the beverages.
Yeah, on the super high end, we have things like Frederick William Marshall's own goblet. Frederick William Marshall was the administrator for the Wachovia settlement. He was one of the most important early residents of Salem, North Carolina. And this is an incredible cut glass goblet made in Maryland and brought to him as a gift from his daughter and granddaughter. At the far other end, you have things like a simple redware jug inscribed True Blue and John Wolfe. And True Blue is probably a reference either to a racehorse or deeply held political beliefs. In both cases, horse racing and politics, alcohol was a huge and important thing in the late 18th, early 19th century. But in both cases, whether you were drinking the same beverage from a cut glass goblet or out of a silver cup or out of this earthenware jug, you could immediately tell where you lay on the spectrum of society.
What kind of objects are on exhibit currently, and how far back do they go?
Well, one of the earliest objects is a archaeologically recovered punch bowl from the excavations out at Rosewell and Fairfield Plantations in Gloucester County, Virginia. It's one of the earliest punch bowls discovered in America. It was discovered in a trash pit that probably relates to an early tavern site at a wharf on the York River. It's a punch bowl that was made in the Netherlands, was brought to this country, was drunk out of, was eventually broken, and was discarded.
Daniel, could you pick an object on display that really speaks to you that you'd like to talk about?
You know, one of my favorite objects is on loan from the Charleston Museum, and it is a silver ladle made in Charleston, probably in the 1740s. In the bottom of its bowl is a 1713 Queen Anne shilling. And as we were getting it ready for exhibit, we noticed, actually our photographer noticed in the course of his work, a faint inscription on the rim of the small ladle. And it turns out that inscription is actually what remains of the edge lettering from an English crown, which is a large silver coin about the size of a silver dollar. And what I realized was this ladle is very clearly making the point that its owner has so much money that they can afford to waste it, turning it into an object like this ladle. So while everybody else around them is still drinking directly out of a punch bowl, this person has enough money to refine their punch drinking and the punch drinking of their friends literally using cash. Cash that has been hammered and turned into a silver ladle.
Part two of my conversation with Museum of Early Southern Decorative Arts Associate Curator Daniel Ackerman. Our spirited ancestors, the decorative art of drink, will remain on display through September 2012 in the G. Wilson Douglas Jr. Gallery at Old Salem Museums and Gardens. There's lots going on at MESDA. They've just completed the renovation of 10 galleries in the past year, installing new lighting, restoring paint colors to their original 18th and 19th century brilliance, and adding dozens of new objects as well. A major renovation of MESDA's Library and Research Center is underway and will open in 2013. Over the past three decades, MESDA has reviewed thousands of primary source materials, and soon many of them will be available to the public online. Well, that's all for today's edition of Triad Arts Weekend. You'll find podcasts of this show and Triad Arts Up Close on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.